This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, 91.7 FM, and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is John Hatch, founder and director of research at the Foundation for International Community Assistance, or FINCA International, and creator of the Village Banking Microcredit Method of Poverty Lending. John Hatch is here today to tell us how village banking and other forms of microfinance are improving the lives of the poor worldwide. Welcome, John.
It's good to be here.
What led you to develop village banking?
Well, I say this quite frequently, but it's the most frequently asked question. And basically, it was just a brainstorm that came to me on an airplane when I was on my second double bourbon on my way to La Paz, Bolivia. I figured God decided to just whisper in my ear at that time and knew I was four sheets to the wind or whatever, flexible enough to not resist the idea, and he planted it, and I knew it was something big. It was an epiphany for me. I scribbled notes. I got my calculator out, and by the time I landed in La Paz, I had pretty much the 80% of the model for village banking, and that next day sold it to the U.S. Agency for International Development. I mean, sold them on the idea, and they gave me a $1 million grant on the spot in local currency to implement the idea immediately in Bolivia. It was one of those magical kind of things. Happened just like that.
And what are the basic elements of village banking?
A village bank is a support group of normally 20, 25 women who come together once a week in the home of one of their members or in the patio in back of the house or under the mango tree. And they come walking in, bringing their own little stools to sit down on. And they meet once a week to basically provide themselves with three key services. The first is self-employment loans for little businesses that they are creating to create their own jobs, generate extra income, and also generate savings. And with this extra income, help keep their kids in school, improve family food security, deal with housing repairs and education of their children, and their own personal empowerment. So the three basic services of a village bank are, one, it's a supply of credit, of small loans. The second service is that it teaches them the savings habit and how to store their savings in a safe place. And the third is just mutual support and mentoring for personal empowerment. We provide the village bank with a starting loan of somewhere between $50 and $100 for each of the members. That's a global loan of, say, $2,000 for, say, a group of 20 women, and then they turn around and make individual loans of that, adjusted to the needs of each borrower. And the more they save, the more they borrow. They can borrow. The loans are usually for a period of 4 months and are repaid in weekly installments, 16 weekly installments.
How is village banking different from other forms of microcredit?
It's different in the sense that it's very locally managed compared to the Grameen system in Bangladesh, where they have a bank officer who comes to the meeting and he keeps the books and he brings the meeting to order. He collects the money and he takes it back to the bank. In our case, the village bankers, we teach them to keep their own books. They are in charge of supervising the loans themselves. They completely have their own management structure. We call it grassroots democracy in action. They create their own bylaws. They elect their own leaders. They elect their own members who want to join the bank. If a member leaves, they replace that with a new member that they approve by vote. They keep their own accounting. They take the money at the end of the meeting and deposit it to a local commercial bank account in two deposits. The part that goes to FINCA would be loan principal and interest, and the part that goes to their own account is their savings. So it's basically very empowering in the sense that it's self-managed by the members themselves, and that's quite different from a lot of other group credit mechanisms, which is usually more controlled by an outside facilitator.
Why have you chosen to give loans rather than grants? What are the advantages of loans over grants?
The advantages of loans is that it makes it far easier for the client to then graduate to the commercial banking structure eventually. It allows us to not have to just continually be pushing money one way, none of it coming back. It's the model of nonprofit groups for the last 50 years has always been a one-way flow of just straight grants going through the nonprofit to the villages, and that's where it stays, and then they have to raise the same amount of money again the next year. In our case, because it's a loan, it gets repaid, it builds discipline, it builds business skills, it builds a business-like approach to development, and the money is there for recycling again and again and again, and it creates a permanent asset that allows a lot larger number of people to participate and to benefit. So, for example, if a woman has been in the village bank for 2 years and decides to retire to her own savings, she does that, and the money that they used to support her business in loans is now available to be recycled to another woman who replaces her. So it's a big revolving loan fund is what it is, and it creates a permanent asset.
Why does Finca lend primarily to women?
Because they're the strongest link in the chain. When you lend to a woman, because she's so close to her children and the nurturing responsibilities of the household, every dollar she earns in her business, probably 95 cents of that is going to go towards investments that help her children. It's going to be food, it's going to be education for her kids, or clothing, or health care, or whatever. So it's the best way to help children. And the reason we got started in this business was that there were 35,000 children dying every day across the planet from chronic malnutrition and hunger-related diseases. Back in 1984, it was 35,000 a day. Well, we figured the solution to that was not feeding programs, giving people donations, but rather just increasing the mother's capacity to take care of herself, take care of her children. That would heal a lot of the hunger problems that exist in the world. So we opted to do it as a self-sustaining, almost an entrepreneurial approach to development, and we think it also honors the participants a lot more. When you give people grants, I think it makes them feel less powerful, more dependent, and they respect themselves less. When they pay the money back, it gives them great power. When they achieve savings, it gives them even more empowerment. In that sense, it keeps them strong, gets them stronger, and it doesn't weaken the system.
How have microcredit programs affected the way women are perceived?
Okay, at the level of the family, one of the things our members most comment on is that my husband respects me more, or my family respects me more. It's the idea that whereas before they were waiting for a husband to bring income home, now they have their own source of income, and they can directly, if there's an emergency in health, they've got money to go and take care of the child. If it's savings, they're putting things away for an emergency. Basically, it allows them to become economically empowered, to take charge, and to better and in a much more timely fashion support their children's needs.
What types of projects are financed? What are some examples?
There's a lot of women who sell out of their homes. They might have a little oven. They might make candy, baked goods, sometimes street food. Outside the home, you see a lot of ambulatory businesses where they go, say, door-to-door selling chicken, or they might sell clothing. Some women buy and sell clothing on consignment. They go door-to-door and they say, okay, what do you need? I can buy it for you in the marketplace, and then you just pay me a little commission for having bought it and brought it to you. So there's those types of businesses. A lot of used clothing businesses where they buy wholesale some of these big lots of used clothing that makes its way into third world countries. They iron, repair the clothing, wash the clothing, make it look pretty good, and then they turn around and sell it for a profit. Selling fruits, vegetables is probably the biggest single one, and used clothing.
What kind of loan repayment rates do you have?
Our loans are, overall, for our 24-country programs, we're running 97% on-time loan repayment. When we say on-time, that's if the amount is overdue by more than 30 days. It's automatic. The whole balance of the loan is placed at risk in our accounting system. And despite that rigorous definition, we're getting 97 on-time repayment. And we believe that this is happening because the women themselves know that if they mess up this opportunity, there's nobody else who's going to lend to them. And then their children are going to suffer. So their discipline is high. Their group discipline is very high. And that also helps to nourish the mentoring and the mutual support aspects of the project.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with John Hatch, founder of Finca International and creator of the Village Banking Method of Poverty Lending. Our topic is how village banking and other forms of microfinance are improving the lives of the poor worldwide. You mentioned amounts as low as $50 as the amount to loan. What levels have you found are effective for helping the people that you're lending to?
Well, first of all, it's a starter system for women who've never had access to credit ever. And so we start as low as $50 simply because it's the first time they've ever managed a loan. But as I say, as they slowly increase their savings balance, then they're entitled to loan more and more. And I would say the average loan now worldwide is something around the order of $150 to $200. And this is for women who've been in the program for maybe 5 or 6 or 7 loan cycles. That would be 2.5 years. 6 cycles would be 2 years.
Could you say more about where you operate geographically?
We're in 24 countries, and that's in Latin America, Africa, the former Soviet Union, and Central Asia. In Latin America, we work in Mexico, Honduras, Guatemala, Salvador, Nicaragua, Peru, and Ecuador, and Haiti. In Africa, we're in Uganda, Malawi, Tanzania, Zambia, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and South Africa. And in the newly independent states of the former Soviet Union, we are in 2 what they call provinces or oblasts of Samara and Tomsk. That's in Russia proper. And we're also in Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and now most recently we've moved into Afghanistan.
How many village banking participants are enrolled worldwide?
Roughly between 350,000 and 375,000 at this time, and number of village banks is running about between 22,000 and 23,000 village banks.
What have been the major challenges in making village banking programs successful?
Number one, I would say access to sufficient capital. This is a problem of our movement as a whole. First of all, let me say that the microfinance movement worldwide is now estimated at 10,000 practitioner institutions worldwide, reaching pretty close to 100 million clients. So that makes it, I think, the most ubiquitous, most wide-ranging development assistance initiative probably certainly since the Marshall Plan, and the biggest, certainly the most widespread. That's in about 125 countries. Now, within that area, that parameter, we have village banking as a movement inside the microfinance movement. Village banking is in approximately 400 programs worldwide in about 60 countries. And then Finca is a fraction of that. If you think of that whole infrastructure as like a big credit factory, but it's a credit factory starved for capital. It has the capacity to lend to almost twice as many poor people as it does today, but because government is not stepping up to the plate, because private investors are not stepping up, showing interest, sufficient interest in investing in this kind of a program, it's just not raising enough capital to work at full capacity. So our biggest single problem is just creating the consciousness out there to raise the funds, whether it's grants, whether it's investment, philanthropic flows, or whether it comes from the multilateral community like the World Bank and the UN, or whether it comes from our bilateral institutions such as AID or British Aid or Canadian Aid. It's just not enough. And it's quite remarkable, having been so successful as a movement, reaching 100 million people, it's just phenomenal that this huge movement, big enough to deserve the name of globalization itself. We're globalization from the bottom up. We don't get the press, but it's globalization from the bottom up. But it's receiving less than 1%, one penny of every development dollar of overseas development assistance. So this is just something that's been our major obstacle, and wherever we've overcome the access to capital, we have found that the programs go very, very quickly. And where the capital is insufficient, they just kind of plateau and sort of stagnate.
Where does the funding that you get come from primarily at this point?
Okay, our funding now, we're about 10% dependent on USAID, the Agency for International Development. That's quite unique in our movement. We've been working very hard for the last 5 years to become not dependent on government, to become independent of government. So our major funding is coming from private sector donors, from private commercial banks. We are lending our loan capital that we're relending. We lend about $230 million a year worldwide. That's what the 97% repayment was that I was referring to earlier. Now, of that, that is the recycling of approximately $60 million of capital, recycled three times a year. Of that $60 million, approximately a third comes from borrowing from local commercial banks in the countries where we operate. Then the rest is coming from individual contributions, donations on the one hand, and then investments in what we call our Village Bank Capital Fund. And we use the Village Bank Capital Fund, in turn, as a loan guarantee mechanism. So if one of our affiliates wants to borrow, say, $1 million from a local bank in country, in local currency, then we'll say, okay, well, we'll guarantee that loan. Here in Washington, we'll send you a letter of credit guaranteeing that loan in U.S. dollars. And so that allows the local bankers to say, okay, you're a good risk, and we'll lend to you. So basically, I would say it's mainly individual donors and investors. About 70% is individual donors, investors, or foundations. And the rest of our capital comes from corporations and churches.
To what extent is there support in the U.S. government from microcredit?
I think there's a lot of lip service paid, but it's declining very rapidly. It's quite, I find, remarkable that on the one hand, we have a very strong rhetoric in development today, and especially in a Republican administration that focuses on free market development and free enterprise solutions to poverty. And here, village banking and other forms of microfinance are just about the most ideal way to create development at the very bottom of the pyramid for the very poorest. It's as free market as you can get. It's as entrepreneurial as you can get. And yet, in this administration, it's been the one that has provided the least amount of support for this type of development assistance. I often look at the pronouncements of think tanks, conservative and whether they're Republican or Democrat, and they're constantly using this free market rhetoric, but they don't even mention microfinance as if we didn't even exist. So it's quite an irony that we probably make the case for free enterprise better than anybody else, and yet we're starved for capital because nobody knows about us. It just doesn't make sense.
What do you see as the major developments that have taken place, specifically in village banking and, well, in other forms of microcredit over the past 5 years?
Well, I think I would put the involvement of youth. One of my focuses is to recruit as many interns as I can get my hands on, students to work as researchers, overseas researchers, because what I feel is that the youth of today are going to be the decision makers of our society 20 years from now. And if I can get an intern into the field for 2 months and she interviews 300 of our clients, that will be an experience for her that she will never forget. She'll be profoundly changed for the rest of her life. She'll carry that with her, and 20 years from now, as she becomes a CEO, as she becomes a religious leader, a politician, any number of other kinds of social roles, she will carry that sensitivity for poverty and the need to end poverty on the planet. So I see it as basically it's inevitable. The next generation will be the ones that end poverty on the planet. But when you get beyond youth, you see relatively, shockingly little engagement on the part of the parents of today's youth and the leaders of today in a commitment to an ending poverty on the planet, and specifically a lack of commitment to this very, very effective tool that we call microfinance, which I like to call it, you know, a poverty vaccine. It's just, it works virtually every time. It's very cost effective. And at the end of the process, not only do people get out of poverty, but they leave the capital behind. Other people can get out of poverty. You can't get any more cost effective than that. So on a consciousness level, that's the biggest kind of thing that I'm noticing, is how this is catching on like wildfire in the younger generation.
Looking overall, how far has microcredit come in meeting its goals?
Well, I would say if you include people who've come through the programs and graduated to their own savings, we're already well over 100 million families. And that's approximately, when we started, we were shooting for about 260 million households was the number of households on the planet living in severe poverty. We've already reached 100 million, and that leaves about 160 million to go. The 100 million have been reached in approximately a decade. So now the infrastructure is in place. The rest of them could be reached as quickly as 5 to 8 years. So I'm very, very convinced not only are we've surpassed our goal, actually, and I think that now the momentum that we currently have, given a stable level of funding, we should be able to get every single severely poor family on the planet who wants a loan, they'll have access to this opportunity.
What do you see as the best next steps to take?
Next best steps, well, I'm working very hard on the research side, because I figure if maybe it's a problem that the public is just not getting the facts. We're reporting anecdotal success stories, but we're not reporting good statistics on how successful these programs are. And so I am putting a lot of emphasis on research as the next big thing that will allow us to tell our story increasingly more powerfully. And the story itself is incredibly powerful, and I just kind of wanted to quote you a couple just numbers here. Our average client is making about $4 a day extra than before she entered the program. And that comes to about $860 a year. And if you multiply that by Finca's 350,000 clients, that's $39.2 million a year in increased wealth that's being generated. The other thing we're finding from our research is that our average borrower takes her loan and purchases, resupplies her business about every 3 days. And so she's quickly spending her capital very, very fast. And so the average client is putting into the local marketplace about $2,630 a month of increased purchasing power. And if you multiply that by our 350,000 clients, that comes out to $3.7 billion per year. That's why I call it globalization. It is a huge, huge activity going on around our planet. It's very successful, and it's almost like criminal that it doesn't have yet enough engagement on the part of the general public, on the part of our policymakers, our opinion leaders, the older generation in particular. And as I say, the great hope is really the youth of today that are engaging quickly in this movement.
When you've gone into the various countries, have you found any resistance to the programs, or are they generally welcomed?
very little resistance because we do not go through government. We do not go through local mayors. We do not generally go through any of the male-dominated power structures. We'll go into a village and we'll ask, well, who's the woman who is most respected in the village? And when we get the same name repeated to us two or three times, we figure we probably have the person where we want to start. So we go see that very respected woman and we say, here's who we are. Here's what village banking does. Do you think you have women in this community who would benefit from this program? And they inevitably say, absolutely, of course. And then we say to this woman, well, okay, would you mind using your home as for the first meeting? And we'll come back in a week, and if you'll just invite other members of your community who could benefit from this program, we'll see you in a week. And it starts really that quickly and that simply, and quite frankly, by the end of that next meeting at her house, we've got an organizing committee started, and they're beginning to work on their bylaws. And 4 weeks later, they're launched as a little village bank.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I guess it's one of engagement. Pay attention because the publicity is building. Be watching for the utterances of our goodwill ambassador, Natalie Portman, the actress. It's time to actually fix our planet, to cure our planet of severe poverty. It's going to happen. It's going to happen in about 10 years. You're either going to be part of the solution or you're going to be part of the problem. Engage it. You know, step up and engage it. And one final thing that I will be promoting personally is I want to promote a kind of a dollar a day campaign. There's a statistic that's very alarming, and that is we are Americans. We are part of the 20% of the most affluent people on our planet today, 20%, but we're consuming 86% of our planet's resources. So if all we did was to reduce our consumption by 1%, and turn that around as a dollar a day and said, I'm going to pledge a dollar a day, $30 a month, you know, do this for the next 10 years. That's going to be my personal pledge to create a planet for my children and grandchildren where there's no more poverty. If all we had was 2.2 million Americans who took that pledge, we would have more than enough capital to get the job done that we're talking about. It's that simple, it's that imminent, and if you're not engaging in this, you're missing one of the great opportunities for transformation of the planet that I think has ever been created.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for asking me. It was a pleasure.
We have just been speaking with John Hatch, founder of the Foundation for International Community Assistance, or FICA International, and creator of the Village Banking Method of Poverty Lending. For more information, call FICA at area code 202-682-1510. Again, that's 202-682-1510. Or check on the web at www.villagebanking.org. The Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week.